Hi there, Jeb Sharp here with How We Got Here, the history podcast from PRI's The World. Each week we take an item in the news and dig into the history behind it. On this episode, we return to the subject of Libya. The World's Marco Werman interviews historian Ronald Bruce St. John about Italy's colonial occupation of Libya in the first half of the 20th century. Their conversation runs about 15 minutes.
Ronald Bruce St. John is author of the new book, Libya, Continuity and Change, and a longtime student of Libya. Dr. St. John, Libya was occupied by Italy in 1911. Why did Italy go there in the first place?
Italy, at the turn of the century, was very interested in acquiring some colonies in Africa. And by that late date in the colonial area, Libya was about the only place left. So they began with sort of a soft occupation, but when that failed, they then turned to more militant means down the road.
And we should point out that petroleum was beginning to be a big global interest at the time, but it was not discovered in Libya until the 50s, so the Italians didn't occupy it for oil, right?
That's correct. There was some suspicion that there might be oil and natural gas in Libya, but very little exploration occurred until the late 1930s, early 1940s, and none of that bore fruit. So there was no indication, hard indication at this point, there was oil and natural gas in Libya.
Now, Italy hadn't really staked much territory out in Africa. They had the Horn of Africa, and it sounds like what you're saying is that Libya, given its proximity on the Mediterranean and the ancient Roman occupation, almost a pride colony for Italy.
Yes, it became that. Eventually, it was known as the Four Shore, with the three shores of the Italian peninsula being the first three, and Libya then considered a Four Shore, somewhat similar to how the French viewed Algeria as an integral part of their homeland.
So what sort of colonial rule then unfolded? Was it full occupation, the Italians in Libya?
Yes, the occupation of Libya actually proceeded in two phases. The first phase began in September 1911, when Italy, after delivering an ultimatum, rather, to the Ottoman Empire, invaded Libya and occupied many coastal areas, some of which are familiar to us today, Tripoli, Benghazi, Tobruk, for example. The Italian forces then halted along the coast within range of their naval guns to consolidate their forces, which enabled the Libyan opposition, under the command largely of Ottoman officers, to consolidate their forces and produce a stalemate. So as the First World War broke out, the fighting had largely stopped. The Italians were pretty much checkmated along the coast, and over the next 4 to 5 years, very little occurred because, of course, Italy was very much preoccupied with events in Europe during World War I. Mm. After the war, there was a temporary peace treaty signed, which was not effective. And finally, in 1923, we have the beginning of the second phase of the Italian occupation, which is known as the Reconquista, the Reconquest. And that was initiated by the fascist government, which took over in Italy in October of 1922. This occupation was a very brutal affair in which the Italian army by 1926 had some 20,000 men in the field, compared to a Libyan force that seldom numbered more than 1,000 and was largely located in the eastern part of the country in Cyrenaica. This is an area which had long been under the influence, socioeconomic and political influence, of the Senussi order, a religious order which had been founded in that part of Libya in the 1840s. They were very much opposed to the Italian occupation and resisted it from 1923 until approximately 1931. The longer they resisted, the more brutal the Italian methods were. They employed the most modern weapons of the day, artillery, airplanes. In 1925, Italy had signed the Geneva Convention prohibiting the use of biological or chemical weapons. But as early as January of 1928, they employed poison gas against the Libyans.
Now, you say it was one of the most brutal periods. I mean, this seems to be fairly unanimous among historians. And in fact, one of our sources said anyone who knows anything about Libyan history and the colonial experience of Italy in Libya It was one of the most brutal colonial wars in modern history. It's just a minefield to get involved in sending troops or even airplanes. Apply that to the current situation. You know, what's the lesson for today of that fighting during the colonial period?
Well, there are not a lot of analogies between what was happening back then and what was happening today. There are a few, perhaps. During the second period of Reconquista, to give you some idea of the brutality, there were approximately 110,000 Libyans in eastern Libya who were eventually put into concentration camps by the Italian forces. That was some two-thirds of the population. Of that 110,000, oral histories today and what's available in Libyan archives would suggest that approximately 70,000 or well over 70% of those died either from disease, maltreatment, or starvation. So it was a very brutal attempt to dampen any opposition to the Italian government. Now, how does that compare to today? The real strongest comparison I think one can make is in the area of tribal activity. One of the effects of the Italian occupation was to push a tribal people into the hinterland of the country and reinforce tribal ties and tribal traditions. Those traditions are still very active today, and as we look at the 140-ish tribes in Libya today, we have seen under first the monarchy after 1951 and then under Gaddafi after 1969, various tribes align with each other to try to gain some influence and domination over the others.
Then World War II breaks out. Italy was part of the Axis. What did that mean in Libya?
Well, as I think most of us are familiar, there was a tremendous fighting back and forth across Libya in the early part of World War II, leading eventually to the British 8th Army occupying Tripoli, as well as the rest of eastern Libya, in February of 1943. With the end of the fighting, Great Britain then occupied eastern Libya and western Libya, Cyrenaica and Tripolitania, and France took control of the oases in the south in what is known as Faisan. They continued that occupation until Libya was finally granted independence by the United Nations in 1951.
Did the Italians make the Libyans fight alongside them during World War II?
No. They were used perhaps as porters and that sort of thing in a very low-level activity. But most of the fighting was accomplished really not by the Italians so much as by the Germans. And the Italians obviously were the Germans' allies, but they weren't very effective in fighting in Libya. And as a result, it was mostly the German army that did the real damage.
And when did Libya cease to be an Italian colony? And how did that come about?
Well, officially, it occurred sometime, I believe, 1947, with the signing of the Italian peace treaty. But certainly after 1943, with the British and the French in occupation of all of Libya, it was only a question of time before Libya would be officially removed of its colonies, not only in Libya but elsewhere. And then as part of that, there was a move to bring Libya to independence, which finally occurred in December of 1951, thanks to the General Assembly of the United Nations, which voted to create an independent Libya.
So what would you say is the overall impact of the Italian occupation of Libya?
Well, it was disastrous, to be honest. The Italians left Libya with an infrastructure of roads, agricultural villages, and other public works, but a terribly poor legacy in terms of a skilled, informed, and politically active citizenry. One of the things that the Italians did was to deliberately discourage the Libyans from gaining any form of education beyond just the elementary level. They did that because they wanted the Libyans to serve in menial, labor-intensive jobs, but not to have the education necessary to rise up and at some point perhaps pose a threat to the Italian administration. Just to give you one example, as late as 1939, there was only one secondary school for Libyans in the entire country, and it had 120 Libyan students. Another statistic which gives you some feel, I think, for the brutality of the Libyan occupation. By the mid-1930s, the Libyan population had been almost halved by famine, war, and immigration. It would actually be 1950 before the population level returned to where it had been in 1913 when the Italians invaded. So from any measure one looks at, the Italian occupation of Libya was a terribly brutal occupation, which had some very, very long-term impact on the ability of the Libyans themselves, once they achieved independence, both to govern their country and to develop the country economically.
As far as kind of the lack of education, the lack of education legacy that the Italians left or didn't leave behind, was that aspect different from, say, French occupation in North Africa?
Yes, it was different to the extent to which the Italians went to try to keep the Libyan people down and to not allow them to get anything more than just an elementary education, the ability to read and write to some degree. That was not an unusual colonial policy, but my point would be that it was much more severely applied in Libya than either the French, the British, or other European countries applied it in most other areas in Africa.
So today, I imagine that Libyans look at outside intervention with great suspicion. I mean, do they have the memory or the historical perspective to look at it in terms of what happened when the Italians were there?
Well, precisely. And that's exactly the point, because it not only this feeling of nationalism, a national identity, and concern for your foreign intervention, it's not only a product of the Italian era, but then during the first 19 years of independence from 1951 to 1969, when Gaddafi overthrew the monarchy, the United States and Great Britain both had large air bases and other military facilities in Libya. Those facilities were very important to the monarchy early on because they were the primary source of income for the state. But as oil was discovered and began to coursing through Libyan society in the second half of the 1960s, the bases themselves became a subject of great debate, not just within Libya, but throughout the region, because you had Gamal Abdel Nasser, the president of Egypt, strongly supporting Arab nationalism, Arab unity, and highly critical of corrupt monarchies as we had in Libya. So he built on the anti-Western feeling by focusing on the U.S. and Great Britain bases. And then subsequently, when Gaddafi came to power in 1969, over the last 40 years, he has continued to emphasize these themes of Arab nationalism and Arab unity and anti-imperialism and anti-colonialism and so forth. So, yes, these memories are very very vivid in the minds of many Libyans. And I think it would be a very large mistake for the United States or anyone else to intervene in Libya beyond what the Libyan protesters, the anti-government forces, specifically asked for.
Well, I was going to ask you, say you sit down, Dr. St. John, in a briefing with the White House or NATO leaders, put the Italian occupation into the discussion. What do you tell them to do about Libya right now?
Well, I think we want to help the anti-government forces to the full extent that they want our help. But I think you need to sit down and talk with them and ask exactly what it is they want. We see varying reports in the press about the anti-government forces asking for this, that, and so forth. But to my knowledge, from my contacts, there's very little appetite for any kind of foreign military intervention beyond perhaps a no-fly zone. And I think even there seems to be considerable debate yet amongst the anti-government forces as to how appropriate it is to have non-Libyan forces in the air over Libya.
You know, there are so few Libya scholars in this country. How did you come to Libya as a kind of focus of study?
Well, I earned a PhD early on, focused actually on Latin American studies, but had the analytical skills to look at countries like Libya. At the time, this was in 1977, when I first went to Libya, I was representing a major multinational corporation. And it was a situation in which Libya was a very attractive marketplace for us, but very little was known about the economics and the politics of the Gaddafi regime. So I took it upon myself to begin to try to study and understand what was going on and why the government was doing some of the things they were. In so doing, I then began to write. I wrote a couple of my first two academic style articles were published in the early 1980s, actually under the pseudonym of my two sons, Nathan Alexander, because by then the U.S. Embassy had been closed in Libya, and it was increasingly dangerous for Americans in Libya, particularly any American who might criticize the regime. So one had to be very careful in those days.
Ronald Bruce St. John is the author of the new book, Libya, Continuity and Change. Thanks very much for speaking with us.
Thank you for having me.
That's it for How We Got Here this week. Thanks for listening. You can find other episodes of the pod at theworld.org/history. You can post comments and suggestions there, as well as suggestions for other episodes. You can also post at the How We Got Here Facebook group page. And if you prefer, feel free to write directly to howwegothere@gmail.com. You can also follow me or message me on Twitter. My handle is @JebSharp. And I think that's it. Speak to you again soon.